Welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm Robert Holly with Home Healthcare News. Before we jump into my conversation with Encompass Health's April Anthony, I want to give a shout out to our podcast sponsor, Homecare Homebase, whose powerful cloud-based home health software streamlines virtually every aspect of your business. Spend less time on paperwork and more time delivering quality care to the patients who need you. Visit hchb.com to learn more. Encompass Health is one of the nation's largest providers of post-acute health care services, offering both facility-based and home-based patient care in 36 states plus Puerto Rico through its network of inpatient rehab hospitals, home health agencies, and hospice agencies. CEO April Anthony leads the company's expanding home health and hospice business. That expansion includes Encompass Health's plans to acquire Alacare for a price tag north of $200 million. I recently caught up with April to discuss that deal, along with Encompass Health's plans for adapting to the patient-driven groupings model. Organizational culture and change management are big pieces of that puzzle, she says. I'd like to now welcome to Disrupt April Anthony, CEO of Encompass Health's home health and hospice business. April, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm really thrilled to be speaking with you right now. For those listening, April and I are talking just a few days after Encompass Health announced its Alacare acquisition. So I'm looking forward to chatting a little bit more about that, how it fits into Encompass Health's strategic plans. And of course, we'll need to touch on the patient-driven groupings model because it's kind of a requirement at this point. Before all that, though, I always like to start these conversations with a brief look back. As they say, you can't know where you're going until you know where you've been. What were the highlights, in your opinion, of Encompass Health's 2018?
Well, it was a really busy year for us at Encompass Health in 2018. And I think probably the big event of the year for us was the rebranding of the former HealthSouth to Encompass Health. So in 2014, the Encompass Health Home Health and Hospice Division sold a majority interest of our organization to HealthSouth. But in 2018, HealthSouth decided to officially jettison their former name and adopt the Encompass Health brand for the entire organization. So the 133 or so inpatient rehab hospitals now go under the brand Encompass Health, as well as our now 285 home health and hospice locations. And so that was probably the dominant event of the year, was just going through all of that brand transition for the entire company and really bringing the family together so that that there was a greater sense of oneness and purpose for the total organization. So that was certainly our big event. But for the home health and hospice division, it was also a terrific year from a growth perspective. We finished 2018 with $930 million in revenue, about $160 million in total EBITDA. And in addition to that, we were able to invest right over $150 million in growth through the combination of acquisitions, particularly led by the Camellia Home Health acquisition, which we did in May of last year. You put all of that together and combine it with the over 200,000 patients that we were able to serve last year between our home health and hospice divisions, providing a little over 5.5 million visits for those patients. It was just an active year. We celebrated it pretty significantly because in August, it was our 20th year anniversary. And so it was really a great way to kind of cap off a busy year and to celebrate the achievement of some pretty significant milestones for our organization.
2019 is shaping up to be a busy year as well. It's not even a couple months into the year and already a pretty major acquisition. As we mentioned on the top of this conversation, that's Alacare. Could you tell me a little bit more about that deal? What's that do for Encompass Health?
Well, Alacare is going to be a terrific addition to our family. And, you know, we've known the Alacare team for over 15 years. They've been customers of Homecare Homebase, which is the company that I also serve as CEO of since the founding of that company in 2001. And so we've had a long relationship with Alacare. And when the opportunity came up to acquire that business, it was one that just fit all of the important metrics for us. You know, when we look at acquisitions, we look at a number of things, but one thing that's really important to us is, do they kind of fit our culture? Will they be able to become part of the Encompass family? And having known them for so many years, we were confident that that was going to be a relatively easy transition. But in addition, they met some other important strategic elements for us. First, they being based in the state of Alabama, were going to allow us to add 3 new inpatient rehab hospitals that we could create overlaps with, so that we could truly bring together our full post-acute continuum in 3 more hospitals in Alabama. They had a great alignment between their home care and hospice divisions. That's one of our other core strategic initiatives. And then third, they were going to help us build out our scale and density in the state of Alabama. And we've come to know over the years that when you can really dominate a market, when you can have significant scale, significant density in your patient population in a relatively tight geographic area, that you can create not only great things from a reputational perspective, but you can also create outcomes from a financial perspective by really leveraging your investments and leveraging your economies of scale. So, boy, Alacare, just, it was a perfect match on so many different levels, and we were really excited to ultimately be the prevailing party in that transaction.
Yeah, just as an interesting aside, we actually had Alacare at the Home Healthcare News Summit back in 2018. So we were pretty familiar with them as well. Definitely seems like a good deal for Encompass Health. I want to talk a little bit more about that deal, but then hit on something you just mentioned, and that's company culture and finding the right fit. But going back to the deal, I think the price tag on that was north of $200 million, a little bit larger than what Encompass Health had previously talked about in terms of M&A on past earnings calls with investors. I know you connected with Home Healthcare News reporter Bailey Bryant recently when the news first broke. Could you talk about that figure and maybe how this was just too good of a deal to pass up, even if it was a little bit bigger than planned?
Yeah, you know, for the last few years, we have definitely signaled to the market that our intent is to spend somewhere between $50 and $100 million on home health and hospice acquisitions. And that number is a number that we feel comfortable that we could achieve, even if a larger scale opportunity doesn't come along. We feel like there's enough tuck-in opportunities out there in the market that we can hit that range regardless of a big transaction. But it's never been intended to sort of create a ceiling. And so when a bigger transaction comes along, as was the case last year with Camellia, and again this year with Alacare, we're not afraid or incapable to reach out beyond that level, but it's really hard to want to commit to that happening when you just don't know what's going to come on the market. And so it was definitely above our stated range, but certainly a level that we feel very confident in our ability to integrate. And because of our capital structure, very confident that we were able to do that transaction, for example, without adding any incremental debt, just by leveraging our existing lines of credit. And so we're comfortable at that level. And I would also say we're not ready to stop. We've got 2 other transactions we've already completed in 2019 that are more of that tuck-in variety. And we still have a pretty full pipeline of other tuck-in opportunities that are going to help us continue to hit on those 3 core strategic initiatives I mentioned previously throughout the balance of this year, as we look to build out more of those overlap markets with our hospitals, as well as between our home health and hospice locations. And so I think we'll continue to be active as the year goes on.
So once that Alacare deal is finalized, their members are likely going to become part of Encompass Health's team. And that's something important to think about, because Encompass Health has consistently been ranked as one of the best U.S. companies to work for, which is something you could really hang your hat on. What have you done as CEO of Encompass Health's home health and hospice business to create a healthy, successful company culture? And then along those lines, what does that even mean to have a good company culture? What's that look like really?
Yeah, you know, in a services business like we are in home health and hospice, I just think there's little that's more important than how do you take care of your people. Because in a services business, people are your asset. They're your product. They're all you have to sell. You don't have any pretty hospitals. You don't have any great cafeterias. You don't have anything that you can really discern. This is why you should come here versus elsewhere, other than your people. And so we've just always believed that building the kind of environment that allows us to attract the very best people in healthcare was going to be essential to our ability to grow and succeed. And, you know, we've been able to really build off that commitment over the years. And in 2018, for example, our home health and hospice division was recognized 27 distinct times as a best place to work in everything from local contests, like here in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, where our home office is based, where we were named the number 3 best company in all of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex to work for, to state-level contests, where we won state-level awards all the way from Idaho to Colorado to Texas to Florida to Virginia, all across the country, to national-level awards, where we were recognized for the 7th consecutive year by Modern Healthcare magazine as a top 100 place to work in healthcare, and where for the 4th consecutive year, already this year in 2019, we've been named a best place to work by Fortune magazine, actually coming in the 54th position this year, which is our highest ranking to date. And so we really feel like creating that kind of environment is so essential to success. And when you think about, you know, what does it mean to build that kind of culture? It really means that you show genuine caring for your people. It means you provide them the right kind of tools, that you invest in them with ample resources to support their needs, that you acknowledge their contributions and the things that they do every day with our patients to make a difference. It means you create the right kind of compensation and benefit structures to make sure that you are financially treating and rewarding those employees. And, you know, at Encompass, we operate off of this really simple paradigm. It's a better way to care. It kind of sounds a little hokey on the surface. There's not much to that statement if you just think about the 5 individual words. But I just had to tell you that for us, those 5 words have been transformative. They've really helped us as an organization realize that every day our primary job is to show up and deliver a better way to care to every person we encounter. If you're in one of our leadership roles, those people are more often our coworkers than they are our patients. And so as I think about my role as CEO, it's really about how do I create the kind of environment that people want to be a part of? How do I make sure they have everything they need to be empowered so that they can then take that mission to the homes of our patients? And what we know about our patients is when they receive that kind of distinctive care, they're going to tell someone. Friends, family, neighbors, but almost always they'll tell their doctors. And when over and over those physicians and referral sources hear about the great care their patients received, it helps us build loyalty and it helps us build growth. And that growth fuels our financial success. And it's really a simple philosophy, but gosh, it has proven to be so important for us as an organization to say to every one of our leaders, what are you doing today to deliver a better way to care for your coworkers? And if you're not sure what that answer is, then you've probably missed the mark today. You haven't delivered on that commitment. And we found that by engaging that simple philosophy and by challenging our people to ask that simple question of themselves every day, that we've been able to really create the kind of teams that all across the nation create that continuity and consistency of Encompass culture. And boy, of all the things we've accomplished in our first 20 years in operation, I think creating a sustainable culture has probably been one of the things that I'm most proud of. The fact that it looks so much the same in Boise, Idaho, as it does in Boston, Massachusetts, as it does in Boswell, Oklahoma, is something that I can really be proud of and think that we've accomplished something.
Apologies if you could hear that ambulance in the background. One of the perks of working in downtown Chicago is you always have a ton of traffic right outside your window.
We get some of that here in Dallas as well.
I'd imagine so. I think it's important to talk about company culture, not just, you know, having to do with attracting and retaining top talent, but I also think that company culture plays into change management. And of course, there's no bigger change going on right now than the patient-driven groupings model. In your view, how are the two connected? Because we often get into the mechanics of PDGM, but don't talk about change management and just positioning your company and staff to be as prepared as you can.
I think that is such a great point. I mean, the reality is, I think the success of change management starts with a strong culture. If you create the kind of environment where people say, you know what, we're on the same team. I know my leadership cares about me. I know they've got our best interest in heart. I believe in the mission that they're pursuing. That aligns an organization to be prepared to deal with big transformative change and process. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings is always that culture follows process, that if you don't have smooth and seamless processes, you can be as nice as you want to be to people, but in and of itself, that won't make them stick. That won't make them follow you. But if you can create an efficient operating model, if you can make sure that every day their world makes sense and it's accountable and it flows in an efficient way, and then you can pour kindness and caring and appreciation on top of it, well, then that culture will really take root. And people will say, I believe in what this company is about. I believe in what this mission is about. And so when you start to take on huge challenges, like PDGM is certain to be for our organization and for our industry as a whole, having that confidence that I know my team will go with me. I know my team will trust when I say we're going to have to behave differently. We're going to have to think differently. We're going to have to process things differently. That knowing that they will follow me on that journey because we've built this trusting relationship over the years is one of the reasons that I have such confidence that we'll be able to respond to the challenges of PDM in an effective way. And I think all change really starts with, you know, am I going to be dragging my team along or are they going to be marching along? And I think our solid culture investments will ensure that our team will march along through that change instead of have to be drug kicking and streaming through the process of change. And that's going to certainly make it easier for us to adapt to the new world of PDGM.
And speaking of that new world, has Encompass Health figured out if it's going to be a net positive or a net negative?
Overall for home health, when we first had the PDGM regulation came out, our quantification was that in addition to the behavior adjustments that we thought we could see as much as a 5% negative change from PDGM. Over the course of the months since the initial announcement of PDGM, we think we've seen a little bit of moderation in that. We think it may get slightly better as we move closer and closer to that date because we've seen some things already beginning to happen. We've seen our percentage of patients that come from facilities has been increasing, partially aided by our clinical collaboration rate that we have with our own Encompass Health inpatient rehab hospitals, as well as some core investments that we made really at the end of 2017 that are really kind of coming into the flow and getting those people fully on board and starting to really make an impact throughout 18 and 19. We're seeing our care transition programs, which is our means of working with acute care hospitals, drive more volume from acute care hospitals. And so those two shifts that are giving us more facility-based discharges are helping mitigate that negative by a little bit. In addition, I would say we're seeing with that shift to more facility-based discharges, we're seeing more clinically complex patients coming our way as well. And if you look at what's happening with clinically complex nursing patients under PDGM, they're one of the patient groups that are seeing positive adjustments from a reimbursement perspective as a result of PDGM. So those two shifts are helping us as we move closer and closer to that January 1st, 2020 date, realize a little less of a negative impact from that. But we still think we're going to see some negative influence from PDGM.
And that's really one of the main points of PDGM in the first place, right? Is to create kind of incentives for providing care to more medically complex patient populations.
Certainly, I think that's one of the things that CMS was attempting to do to really kind of create a rebalancing of where patients are coming from. I will certainly tell you that it is my strong opinion that they've overcorrected. Mm-hmm. That in the case of therapy, they have really gone too far. And if you look at the average cuts that you're seeing come to patients that have historically been recipients of six or more therapy visits, I think those cuts are too extreme. I think think they could result in those types of patients actually ending up getting higher cost care rather than coming to home care, because I think some home care providers are simply not going to be able to support the financial cost of delivering that service because it's going to be so misaligned with the revenue for those patients. And so I certainly see, you know, the attempt that they were making, but I'm anxious that they may have overcorrected in the case of therapy. And there were really two reasons that that happened. One, it was not just simply removing the therapy thresholds, but interestingly enough, at the same time that CMS did that, they also made a shift in using data for determining therapy cost based on cost report submissions rather than based on Bureau of Labor Statistics data. And it sounds kind of like, well, gosh, is that that big of a deal? But we really, as we look at the analysis of that, believe that it is a pretty big deal. If you remember, you know, cost reports really haven't been the basis of reimbursement for almost 20 years now. And the level of specificity that people are using in reporting cost report data is not nearly as detailed as it used to be, because they're a little bit more of an informational report over the last 20 years compared to back in the days of cost reimbursement, where you were very tightly honed on how you did that because cost reports were routinely audited. Well, they haven't been audited for 20 years. And so for CMS to, at the same time that they're readjusting the distribution, to shift the method of cost determination from Bureau of Labor Statistics data, which is routinely reviewed and audited and reviewed for accuracy, and going to cost reports, which haven't been audited for 20 years, we think that is part of why we've seen such a big correction in therapy reimbursement. And we anticipate that we're probably going to see that that service line is will soon be a very significantly underpaid service line. And we believe that provides a lot of value to the patient, and that there's a lot of value that can be brought to the system by caring for those kind of patients in the low-cost setting of home care. So we're anxious about that overcorrection and have been spending a lot of time in Washington and with CMS and HHS talking about our concerns around that particular issue. So we're pretty anxious about that, but we'll see how it all plays out in the final months here.
Do you think CMS and HHS have been listening to those concerns?
You know, I think they hear us. I think they understand what we're saying. It's really hard when you're meeting with HHS and CMS to determine if they're agreeing with what you're saying.
But sure, I certainly... There's always a difference between hearing and listening as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think they understand the perspective of what we're communicating. You know, we'll see if and how that manifests itself in any revisions that may come down in the rule that we'll get in early July.
So therapy changes under PDGM, maybe that's an overcorrection, but I'm wondering, do you see any opportunities you're not anxious about but excited about under PDGM? For example, I think we recently connected in preparation for this conversation, and you touched on wound care as a potential opportunity.
Well, I think we definitely see that those clinically complex patients, including wound care patients, are ones that that get some pretty significant positive adjustments. If you were just to, you know, outline all of the nearly 200,000 patients that we saw as a company last year and look at their reimbursement, and if the same facts, same care plan were to be put in place and compare it with PDGM versus our current system, you certainly can see there's some big winners. The bell curve is pretty big. There's some pretty significant winners, patients that may get 25% to 35% incremental reimbursement, and there's some pretty big losers who are going to see 25% to 30% negative reimbursement. And it's one of the things we really think with CMS we've been talking to them about is saying, hey, this bell curve is just too large. There are the tails of this thing spread far too far when you start seeing 25% and 30% adjustments. That's pretty risky, because you could see, you know, some major overcorrections happening and some unintended consequences. So certainly, you know, as you look at those episodes that are getting big increases, they are those clinically complex patients. They're patients with multiple wounds who certainly in the past, you can make a strong case for those patients have been under reimbursed in the past. And this is probably a good correction for them. But because this was all done in a budget neutral way, you know, in order to solve a problem, you had to create a new problem. And that's what we fear may have happened, is that they solved the problem of underfunding treating of wound patients by now underfunding therapy patients. And hopefully we start to find our way back toward the middle of that bell curve, perhaps with this July proposed rule or with the ultimate rule that comes out, give or take, late October, early November.
What about the shift from a 60-day unit of payment to 30 days? I feel like that's something we really can't talk enough about. Just from my perspective, I imagine that has the potential to be fairly disruptive in terms of cash flow and billing operations. Do you kind of see that also as something with the potential to be very disruptive?
I certainly think that it will be from a cash flow perspective. And as we've kind of modeled out what we think is going to happen with this transition, we think there's going to be sort of a one-time gap that's going to be created as you move from 60-day payments to these 30-day payments, that you're going to immediately see a little bit of elongation of your day sales outstanding, that you're going to pick up some incremental DSO, but that once you get into the flow of those 30-day payments, that then it'll sort of come out pretty even to the cash flow that you're getting today, but you're going to see that one-time gap that's going to happen right at the beginning, which is going to extend the DSO calculation for most providers. And so we think that certainly could be concerning. We also think just the billing activity, certainly you're going to be sending twice as many claims, you're going to be posting twice as many payments. That's certainly going to add some level of impact to organizations. We're pretty confident that it's not a one-to-one ratio, that not double the effort's going to result in double the people, because we've been working closely with Homecare Homebase to make sure that we've got some added features and functionality in the system in order to be able to make that billing process easier and more efficient so that we don't have to double our billing staff. And I think all of the technology providers are working, you know, in the same way to try to make that process a little bit easier. But I definitely think that it's going to perhaps result in some increase in our billing personnel just to manage the double the flow of activity, both on the billing submission and on the claims payment posting.
When we talk about cash flow maybe being disrupted in the early going, maybe there being a gap early on, I think some of the projections that I've seen out there specifically target January and February. Is that in line with what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think we'll see the impact of that kind of that gap certainly in the first 60 days of PDGM, and that gap is probably in our modeling looking like it could create as much as 5 to 10 days of incremental DSO, and it's something providers need to be prepared for if they don't have the cash flow to manage as much as an incremental 10 days between now and the end of the year would be the time to be preparing for that, whether that's with lines of credit or just stockpiles or storing up cash so that you are prepared for that. And certainly another thing to be concerned about is, will the intermediaries be prepared for this change? It's one thing for us and for our vendors to be prepared to send the bills, but all the intermediaries have to be prepared to process them. And the timeline on this thing is pretty short. Even though we've known about PDGM for a few months, we haven't had the specifics that are really necessary from a coding perspective to fully code the software to deal with it until some new additional clarifications come out. And so I'm worried that the payer side will be farther behind than the provider side, and that could create a need for even greater cash flow preparation in advance of that January-February timeframe.
We talked about change management and how company culture fits into that. But what about overall PDGM mitigation strategies? What are some good examples of those? What is it Encompass Health doing specifically?
Yeah, I think generally when I look at PDGM, I think the whole tenor of the rule is just going to require us to figure out, how do we do more with less? How do we figure out how to be more efficient in our delivery of care? And so I think it's going to cause us to have to really look at, how do we improve our use of non-visit-based interventions? Are there things that we can do with remote monitoring or high-risk phone calls or IVR solutions or care management divisions? What can we do to try to create meaningful interactions with our patients that aren't necessarily visit-based. And that's a little outside of the bailiwick of many home care providers that have really spent their time focused just on sending out clinicians to the home. I think PDGM is going to challenge our industry to say, boy, you have to think about it a little bit differently. And certainly we found at Encompass over the last few years that using those non-visit-based interventions is a way to really drive efficiency. I think the other thing that I think we're really going to have to do under PDGM is make sure that we make an incredibly efficient use of our resources, that when we do send clinicians out into the home, that we're sending the right clinicians. One of my favorite phrases is, I want everybody working at the top of their license. I want to make sure that RNs are doing work that only RNs can do, that LPNs are doing work that maximize what they can do, PTs and PTAs the same way. And we call that optimization. We want to optimize each person's contribution. And so I think that's going to be incredibly important. And then I think when you look at your full-time staff members, making sure that for those people who you have committed salary relationships with, that you're getting the productivity level from each of those individuals that you expect is going to be another key. If you're used to having an RN, maybe that you're only getting 22 visits a week of productivity, you may have to figure out, boy, is there any way I can get to 24 or 25 visits of productivity out of that employee over the course of the year, over the course of PDGM. So it's going to be important to optimize your resources. It's going to be important to use non-visit-based interventions. And it's going to be important to just really look at your care planning very, very critically to figure out, am I truly adding value in every single encounter? If I'm just going by and being a professional visitor, I may have to think twice about that. That may not be what we're intended to do. We've got to really make sure every visit is value-added to drive the outcome that we're seeking with the care plan.
April, we probably have 2 or 3 minutes before we have to wrap this conversation up. I've really enjoyed chatting so far. Before we go, I wanted to ask about Washington advocacy efforts, you know, in addition to just talking CMS and HHS. Could you talk a little bit about some of the advocacy efforts you've been a part of? I know a lot of those have been targeting the behavioral adjustment aspect of PDGM.
Absolutely. So through the Partnership for Quality Home Care, which we've been a member of for a number of years now, we've been spending a lot of time, certainly starting with the regulatory bodies, with CMS, with OMB, with HHS, with even people like the Domestic Policy Council, basically anyone who could potentially have input into this new rule and is willing to listen. We've been meeting with all of those parties, trying to help them understand why we're so concerned about the transformative change that we think PDGM will create and the pace of that change and the approach to that change. And, you know, again, we don't know how successful we're being, but we're doing our best to make sure that they're fully informed and fully aware. Perhaps more interesting is the work that we're trying to do on the Hill. And we're very excited that a few weeks ago, Senator Susan Collins was a lead sponsor of Senate Bill S-433, which is a bipartisan bill. And not only is it bipartisan, it really covers the broad spectrum of folks. We've got very conservative Republicans like Rand Paul. We've got more moderate Republicans like Susan Collins. We've got moderate Democrats like Debbie Stabenow. We have more liberal Democrats. We've got a broad base of sponsors on that. And boy, to me, that says home care is not a partisan issue. So many things in our country these days are partisan, but home care is something that we can all rally around as being the way all of us, no matter our political affiliation, would like to receive our care as we age, is to do so in our homes with dignity, with the support of our family, surrounded by the things and the people that we love. And so we're really excited about the level of support that we're finding for the Senate bill. And we're working right now in hopes that by approximately the end of April, we'll have a companion bill coming out of the House with a similar level of bipartisan support for that bill. And those bills are really focused around the behavioral change adjustment, as you mentioned, making sure that that adjustment, which we think is very arbitrary, that is not based or founded in actual observed behaviors, and that it is an assumed behavior that is more extreme than anything we've seen the industry do in the last 20 years, we think that is really an egregious element of PDGM. And All of these bills in both House and Senate are really focused primarily on those areas, but then also pick up some other potential areas of concern, such as the homebound status. The Senate bill actually speaks to the elimination of the homebound requirement for home health care. So we're encouraged about the support we're receiving on the Hill, and we're hopeful that CMS and OMB and HHS will straighten this thing out before we ever have to get to passing those bills into law. But if we end up there, we're encouraged about the position that we're in presently with those resources.
That's April Anthony, CEO of Encompass Health's home health and hospice business. April, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Glad to do it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights on the home health, home care, and hospice industries, subscribe to our daily or weekly newsletters at homehealthcarenews.com. I'm Robert Holly, and this has been a production of Aging Media Network, Chicago, Illinois.